It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
All right, we are live. I mean, not really, but you know, things to talk about. But before then, I just moments ago found out Jessica Walter died. Actor Jessica Walter.
I don't remember who that is.
Nowadays, she would best be known as Archer's mom on Archer or Lucille Bluth on Arrested Development. I believe she was the mom on the ABC show Dinosaurs. She's been around forever. She was in Play Misty for Me and a bunch of other great movies and TV in her younger days. Amazing actress. And then sort of transitioned into being an amazing comedic actress after that. Really was a big fan and kind of sad.
That is too bad.
Yeah, she was awesome.
She wasn't.
Sorry?
How old was she?
80, which she looked amazing for 80. Yeah, but
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah. But that wasn't what I was going to talk about. We should talk about last week. You already know what happened, but we should tell the audience about what happened. Okay. So, for those of you just joining us the first time, don't listen to last week. It's not very good. But some shit went down. So I was kind of a dick last week, and I largely blamed it, I think rightly so, on sleep deprivation. The night before, I had gotten very little sleep. I'd slept a little bit in the day, but it had just thrown me off, and that was bad. No big mystery there, except I didn't know why I didn't sleep so well. I had theories, but I'm pretty sure now those theories are blown out of the water. So... let's temporarily switch to a different story. As many of you know, I spend a lot of my time drinking decaffeinated homemade iced tea. I buy two of these big bottles of zero calorie sports drink each week. I drink them because they are tasty. And then I reuse the bottles and I put these decaf tea bags in here and put them in the fridge with some warm water, and then they turn into tea, and I drink them. And when I finish drinking them, I rinse them out and put in another tea bag and more hot water and do that throughout the day, sometimes lots of times a day. And then each week I get new ones so they don't get too grody. Now, some days I'm drinking a lot of them and I get ahead of it. So like I finished one and the other one just got put in a half hour ago and it's not even cold. And so what are you going to do? I usually drink water, which is fine. And I like water fine. And I drink lots of water. Recently came into possession of some of these. And I've used these before. The little singles packets of like drink mix. Somebody had sent a care package for things. And it had a few of these. And those drink packets are almost always sugar free. Because you can't fit enough sugar in there, like if you actually to make them with sugar, they'd have to be much larger.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Sure. And Trish hates artificial sweetener. I live on artificial sweetener, so she gave them to me, and I'm drinking them. I'm like, these are not. I'm like, I should get some of these. Like, not these necessarily, but I should get these again to have around, so that when I'm out of iced tea, I can have these every once in a while. So I bought some. You know, on Hy-Vee, and I bought some knockoff Crystal Light, and it's good. And I'm like, I should get some more. So I got a couple more flavors, and they're nice. And I have them every once in a while. I usually have them in the evenings because that's usually when I've like run out of all my iced tea. And so I got this new flavor, Wild Strawberry, of the Hy-Vee House brand. And I've been drinking them, and I believe on the day before the podcast in question, I had had two of them because I had done with the iced tea and I drank one and I was like, oh, that was tasty. I want another one. So anyway, had the podcast. It's kind of a dick because I didn't sleep at all, hardly. And then come around Friday, I'm out of iced tea and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go make one of these. And I go, okay, we'll have this guy again. And I look at the box and I see it says with caffeine, which didn't know that was a thing. I mean, and I bought these in person. I know I'm getting the groceries online, but I got these because we had forgotten to order something. And so I ran in to get it and I just grabbed some of these. So, I mean, no excuse except that I didn't look for the word caffeine because it did not occur to me. I also didn't look for the word heroin or, you know, milk chocolate or, you know, now with a lemon pepper. No, because I didn't think these had these. And I was like, holy shit, they got caffeine. And then I was like, how much? And I looked on the back of the thing, per packet, 120 milligrams.
Which is
for those of you, yeah, this is a whole lot. When I have like a 20 ounce bottle of Diet Mountain Dew, as I have want to have sometimes in the morning, that's like 110.
Yeah.
And that's a whole of Diet Mountain Dew, like the shit that I drink specifically. So as Trish basically said, it's basically an energy drink in a little pouch.
And I had two
of them. I remember, and I thought it was because with dinner, because we had ordered dinner that night, I thought it was because I'd had a can of Diet Coke with dinner, which is not great for me. I do it every once in a while, and I know there's a risk because it has some, but it has like 50 milligrams. Mm. And I've been drinking a lot of caffeine recently because it's winter and stuff. So I blamed it on that. That and the movie I watched that kind of riled me up. But now I'm like, nope, I know what it was now. It was the 240 milligrams I drank that night.
Wow.
Yeah. Now that I know, it's awesome. Because I bought more of them. Because it's real handy in the morning.
Oh, sure.
Like,
sure.
You want a cup of coffee? Fuck that. Just give me a drink of strawberry knockoff Crystal Light. And I told this story to my sister, and she was like, okay, she reacted like you do, and she was surprised. And she's like, we'll be fine. We don't drink the knockoff ones. We only drink the name brand Crystal Light. And I was like, you are not fine. Because in looking for these, I found some several weird things. For one thing, Hy-Vee on the app when I'm ordering doesn't think these have caffeine.
Oh,
and I'm like, is there a variety that doesn't or what? Because the picture on the thing is not, and it doesn't mention it. But when you're typing it in, there are ones that do have caffeine, and Crystal Light has them. Crystal Light, a little more sensible, 60 milligrams per, so half.
Sure.
So that's better. But Crystal Light, apparently these are just a thing. And I'll bet some of you are listening going like, yeah, this is the thing. Didn't know. Did not know these came in leaded. did not know there was a turbo version of grown-up sugar-free Kool-Aid going on. But there is. And I'm happy to know it. And I'm buying it now and making use of it. But just be prepared to know this fact. If you're like, oh, let's buy some, you know, zero calories, some crystallizer. Look at the package for caffeine.
So different people metabolize caffeine differently. So do you, are you one of those people
mine's that through the mouth and in the stomach? I mean,
it's about dosage. Do you need a lot of caffeine for there to be an effect, or do you actually need not very much for it to have an effect?
Mine is, I develop and lose tolerance very quickly. So it is very much based on how much I have been drinking recently. In fact, if I'm like, wow, I've really been drinking a lot, sometimes I'll be like, you know what? I'll skip a couple days, or more likely I'll have a day or two where I just have a little. Cause if I've been hitting it really hard and I flat out skip, I'll get some headaches. But I try and manage it so that it will continue to be useful for me, because I know people that have been drinking so much and do it so much that they'll fucking just die if they don't have it. But meanwhile, they can be tossing back Coca-Cola right before bed in huge quantities and it has no impact on them whatsoever. And I don't want to be there. So I'm very keenly aware. I also think in my case, a lot of it is psychological, which is to say, had I known what I was drinking, I probably wouldn't have gotten those 2 hours of sleep. I think a lot of it is knowing that I'm drinking caffeine and then my brain's like, oh yeah, no, you're clearly awake now. but I'm not sure about that one. But yeah, it varies a lot. I drink a fair bit. I mostly am just like, give me something with a shit ton of caffeine and I'll drink one of them. And then if I'm tired, I'll deal with it later. And I tend to have cutoff points in the day where like you should not have caffeine past this point, or at least you should have very little caffeine past this point, that kind of thing. If I know what I'm doing, if I know I'm going to be staying up late, then screw it, I'll drink it later. On the weekend, I'm much more likely to have a late afternoon caffeinated drink than I am on a weekday.
I don't remember caffeine ever having any particular impact on me personally. I rarely had it when I was growing up. And when I did, I just don't remember feeling anything, like any extra pep or energy or anything.
Well, I'm going to get you some Wild Strawberry Knockoff Crystal Light, and we'll toss back about three of them and we'll see what you do.
I know what it'll do because
my prediction is you'll be blurry on the camera because you'll be vibrating.
No, I know what'll happen because eventually in college, very early in college, like during the first half of the first semester, I decided to pull an all-nighter, the first all-nighter I ever pulled ever, because I never did all-nighters in high school. So this was like 1 or 2 months into college, I decided to pull an all-nighter and I got some stuff that's concentrated caffeine, thinking it would help me stay awake.
You got no dose.
Something like a Vivarin, maybe something like that. But I took it. And this is the first time I ever took anything with caffeine in it where I felt an effect. But the effect was not, I got jittery and stayed awake. I got very sick. I felt dizzy. I had to lay down and I fell asleep. I mean, it didn't keep me up at all. It made me sick. And then after that, if I had anything with caffeine in it, even a small amount, I would feel ill. So since about a month into college, I have not had any caffeine except accidentally. And I only knew I had it accidentally because I would feel sick. And I would say, hey, was there caffeine in that? And someone said, oh yeah, there is. Or sometimes it wasn't caffeine. Sometimes it was ginseng.
Oh, really?
I responded to ginseng the same way. Now, chocolate, I don't have that response.
Chocolate, people talk about how chocolate has caffeine, and it's technically true. It has incredibly little. It has less than decaffeinated coffee. Look at the packet of chocolate. It won't tell you how many milligrams because there's such a little amount.
Right. Chocolate, aside from that one time I took a mega dose of caffeine, there's no thing I've ever ingested that made me feel any kind of effect, only chocolate. And I have to eat a really dark, like there's got to be a lot of chocolate in it for me to feel an effect. And it's a generally positive effect, so I like it. But other than that,
caffeine. I don't even know if you can get the pills anymore. I remember those. No-dose and Vivarin and all. Yeah, it's as safe as coffee. Yeah, if you take the dosage you're supposed to. If you're a fucking college student, we were tossing it back in goddamn handfuls.
Well, I think I follow the dosage. It's just I did.
I'm sure you did. I'm just saying the path to degrees in the 90s is littered with the bodies. There's a reason they made the goddamn Saved by the Bell episode about caffeine pills, because back then we were abusing the shit out of those. We were all long haul truckers.
I can't understand though why it made me, like, it didn't have any of the effects that it has for people typically, like alertness. It just made me feel very sick. I had a headache. I couldn't,
people
don't, light sense. It was like a migraine. I had like a migraine is what it was.
Yeah.
Like.
people often don't understand that a lot of chemicals and drugs out there do different things in different dosages.
Yeah, that's true.
And that always confused. I mean, to the degree that there's some shit that, like, this is a sedative, unless you take a bunch of it, then it's a fucking hallucinogen or things like you can mess yourself up. And I think I probably have done that now when I just get like too into it. In fact, I have had situations recently where I'm like, I just drank too much of this. Although in some cases it's been diet soda from a drive-thru. And in some cases I have later figured out I'm pretty sure it was not diet. And so I'm pretty sure it was a massive amount of caffeine and a massive amount of liquid sugar.
I might be figuring this out right as we're talking about it, because recently I read a study that suggested that that people who have who get motion sick very easy, like I do, this study suggested that what's happening is your body is behaving as if it's been poisoned. And when I think about my reaction to caffeine, that's what it's like. And I think if the caffeine was having any kind of effect in terms of being a stimulant, that was completely overshadowed by what my body was doing to treat it like a poison. And I think my body treats not only lots of things that I eat or ingest as a poison, it treats a lot of situations like a poison. So I'm
pretty
like,
sure your body's been like, trying to kill you for years.
Yeah, but that's what I think too. I'm a poison to myself.
That's my guess, actually, with the caffeine at this point, is because that's another factor you get with people when they ingest something for the first time, or not even for the first time, but when they ingest something and it has a horrible reaction to them, frequently for many years, if not the rest of their life, they get that reaction automatically. Like the common one I know is, I ate this food and then I was really sick. Mm-hmm. And now even if I smell that food, I get nauseated. I bet that's happening to you with the caffeine now. And I'm guessing you haven't taken any large doses in these times, so you just accidentally get some. So all you get is that reaction.
No. Right. That's probably what it is.
And I mean, I think it's better. Caffeine is a tool, but it's one of those, if you can go through life not using it, it's undeniably better.
Well, people are often amazed to know I got through college without really using any caffeine at all.
Yeah, I'm amazed at the people who got through college without any recreational drugs and illicit sex. So, you know, everybody's got their own levels.
Yeah, that applies to me also.
See, and it's amazing. I'm like, what?
How did you get through college?
How does college work for you people? What'd you study and do classes and shit? I don't know. I was discovering new religions, gender identities, and sexual orientations in a little haze of sex, drugs, and not rock and roll. College radio, you know.
I don't know. I worked a lot. I was like, you know, I had 2 and 3 jobs at a time sometimes. And so for me, it was a lot of work.
I did have a job. But during that job, I sometimes was still on drugs and worked with people I was sleeping with. So it's still all kind of fit together.
I mean, I was not a good student. I skipped classes a lot. Part of that was I thought to myself, hey, I'm paying for this. You know, I was paying for it. Now my parents, I was. So it's like, if I thought a professor was doing a bad job or whatever, if I thought it was stupid that I was being forced to take a class, I would say, you know what, I can stand to get a B or even a C in this class. I don't have to show up every day. And I usually could get a B in a class without showing up. But what I would do is I'd go, you could rent canoes on the Iowa River. I would do that. I would go hiking. I mean, I would just do whatever I wanted, or I would pick up more hours of work. I would do that too. But when I had time to do other things besides work and schoolwork, and I wanted to skip a class, I'd go out and
I'll bet it would have been like that. Very different if I was living in Iowa City. I was in Grinnell, Iowa. There was nothing.
There's nothing to do?
No, except on campus. They worked really hard to give you a bunch of shit. It was really easy to start a group and get funding for it. It was really easy to throw a party in one of their big spaces and get money to throw it. We had a movie theater. We had a coffee house in the basement of one of the dorms. Like, yeah, they worked really hard to keep us entertained. I mean, we paid for it, but
it is pretty amazing how many things there are to do around Iowa City that's not just going to a bar, but you can do that too. I mean,
Iowa City's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Or at least it was.
You can do all those things that college students typically do. But if you don't want to do those things, there's lots of other things to do. There really, really is. It's a pretty cool place to go to college, I think. I mean, I didn't like college overall, but I didn't have a problem living in Iowa City or enjoying the amenities of Iowa City. So.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Magical Talking Cat Podcast, only podcast that is poised to get into this NFT market. We are going to sell NFTs of individual episodes for about $500,000 a piece. So you could own a piece of our history and enjoy that. Just give us a lot of money. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 523. And I don't think I know what an NFT is.
Oh, they're blowing up right now. Blowing up. Non-fungible tokens.
Oh, yeah, I know what a non-fungible token is, sort of.
Yes.
Like pieces of art that people paid lots of money for.
Yes. Yeah. And you can do that in a digital form now. And so using blockchain and encryption and all that, you can find a way of tagging something so it is, you can prove it is unique.
Yeah.
And that version. So like, again, our podcast, anybody can download a copy of our podcast, give a copy to somebody else, change the format, whatever. But we're going to make one that's encrypted in a special way so it can't be changed and it is provable that it is the episode. And because it is unique, collectors will pay big fucking money.
Well, maybe they will.
No, they will.
It's an interesting thing, I think. Do you think it's dumb or?
I think for 2 seconds, I'm interested at the concept. And then immediately after that, I hate humans and capitalism just instantly. What? I'm like, this is an interesting idea by which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and it's on the dumbest shit. Like, ooh, there's this art out there that we all love and can enjoy, but I want a copy that's essentially identical to all others, but it has a special sticker on it. Nobody can take it off, so then it's worth millions. That's awful. That's absolutely terrible. It's pretty sweet for the artist, but it's awful that that's a thing. Like, it's artificially creating wealth out of nothing, and I hate it.
I don't artificially creating wealth out of nothing. What does that mean? I don't
it understand. Means, I mean, if it person- means the NFT is no more valuable than any other copy of said piece of data, except that somebody for fucking status reasons is willing to pay a bunch of money for it.
Isn't that how value is determined anyway? Isn't people just decide?
Yes. And this is a way to inflate it. This is creating more widgets that rich people can pass around and show off their rich. I don't in general like the high end economic items in general. It's this is a luxury of luxuries that I'm like, so people are spending $1 million on a unique version of a JPEG that anybody can get their hands on. Jesus Christ, that money could be better spent. Like, do you know how many people are fucking starving in whatever state you live in? And yet you're throwing this money at a JPEG. It's hating the ostentation of Bentleys and high-end sports cars, but at least those do a thing and aren't readily available for free throughout the world.
So
like, this one's really bad. Like, it's ridiculous to have cars that are as expensive as Bentleys. It'd be more ridiculous if there were Bentleys everywhere, but you spent the kind of money you spend on a Bentley just to get a certain dashboard thing, and all the other Bentleys were essentially free or very cheap.
Okay. So, but this is a thing, though, that, I mean, like you said, it can help the artist, for example.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people could benefit from this kind of thing. I mean, if there's a few examples of it being used in a way that seems ridiculous or even insulting, I mean, does that have an impact on how we see how it could benefit other people, like, more often or most of the time?
Absolutely not. And if you want to show me some instances where that's happening, I might change my view.
And I have no idea.
Which there may be, but
yeah. Well,
at this point, all I know of is these kind of things. Is that, again, it is a high-end luxury that was created out of nothing and holds no intrinsic use. It's not even a Guga that is $1 billion and you buy it because nobody else has it and only you can have it there. No, somebody else can have the same goddamn thing. Theirs just doesn't have the invisible encrypted tag on it.
Okay. But I mean, I'm thinking of potential. Like, I'm thinking you know, like, what's coming to my mind immediately, and maybe this is dumb, I'm thinking of you, actually. So let's say you want to sell your book.
Yep.
And you make a special digital copy
that
a person can have on their Kindle. And it's got something special that on this person's Kindle, nobody else is going to have it. Now, on the surface, that seems like a ridiculous, silly thing, but someone's willing to pay you $1 million for it. I feel like if that person's willing to pay you $1 million for it, you should sell it for $1 million and you should get $1 million. And you're not.
And I would.
Yeah, exactly. In a heartbeat. I think that's great. I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, now you've got $1 million and you didn't have $1 million before. And you're probably a person who's going to do what I would consider sensible and good things with that $1 million. And now that person, if that person who gave you $1 million is a rich idiot, that person has less money than they had before. So it's like, this seems like a win-win.
So. To me, it is a ridiculously arbitrary and gross redistribution of wealth. And that's the thing. Because what happens is somebody gives me $1 million for that one, and I do that for every book I write, and I start pumping those books out. And the next thing you know, I'm super rich, and I may or may not be using that responsibly.
Well,
like, the fundamental concept of NFTs doesn't bother me. The way I believe it is currently and am confident it is going to be used does. I mean, again, you can go back to the Bentleys. That's a high-end craft. People started making those who did not have a ton of money, and people bought them, and it's great. And now, if you work for Bentley in the upper echelons, you're one of those people now. And it didn't redistribute the wealth, and that was great. No, it just, again, altered the gap in a slightly different way.
I don't know. It seems different to me. It seems like, you know, the barrier of entrance to being a part of that market seems pretty low. Seems like
it's the barrier of entrance is incredibly low. The value of presence is only what people are willing to pay.
But that's so it becomes true.
It's just another popularity contest. No, if I'm buying a bicycle, I'm buying a bicycle that's good. If I'm buying a digital artifact and I'm paying $1 million for it, I'm going for the person that I think is the hot shit. So, I mean, I will freely admit, it is no different than the current art world. I also don't like the current art world. And again, the whole idea where, well, you could buy an original or you could get a print for much cheaper applies, except in this case, it's even more stark because it's a file copy. Because yes, it would be great if somebody bought the special version of my book for $1 million. But you know what would be better? If a whole bunch of people just bought it for 10 bucks.
Sure.
That would be so much better.
I mean, I guess.
And everybody would have it, and I would still have $1 million. 100,000 people would have to buy it.
Okay, but everything you're talking about is determined by what people, including yourself, decide to value. Like you said a second ago, if you bought a bike, you'd be buying a bike that's good, but there's no objective definition of a good bike. The things you value in a bike determines whether or not it's going to be good. I mean, you can argue that there's more objective things like, well, it's got two wheels and when you pedal it, it moves. That's a pretty universal requirement for a good bike. But the thing is, when it comes to any kind of art, I mean, art is obviously a little bit more subjective thing, but still, everything you purchase or everything you exchange is going to be based on value, and there's going to be subjective aspect to that.
Absolutely.
And art is a thing that we need. It's not just
absolutely.
We don't need a particular kind piece, but we do need art. So that's something we're going to exchange.
Yes.
And people are going to value it. And so it's like, how do you decide that this valuation of this art is bad versus this valuation of this art? I mean, I don't know. It seems
again,
like an arbitrary.
It's the economic extreme. And I can't give you a price point. But there are people on, say, DeviantArt, and people of all sorts of money levels go to DeviantArt and they browse through people, or somebody says, check out this artist, they're cool. And you go, and you might not be rich or anything, but you see this one, and you're like, I like this. I want to order a print of this, or I even just want a copy of the file to put up. I'll pay 10 bucks, I'll pay 20 bucks, I'll pay 50 or 100 if it's somebody's really impressive. Lots of people can do that. If I'm the guy who's like, I want to blow a couple of million on digital art, I'm not just browsing DeviantArt. The random people who are out there aren't gonna know. It's gonna be the people who the other fucking rich people told me about, or who is in the news, or who I think is cool. It becomes a status thing again on a high enough level. You got to be the hot shit artist to get those. And if you are just a mediocre artist, or you don't have a connection, or you aren't famous, you're not getting the money. So the ones who are already going to be very successful artists are going to be more successful, or are more successful financially. The ones who are lesser known, I don't think a whole bunch of them are going to suddenly be, oh, look at this JPEG. We need NFTs of these people for hundreds of thousands. It could happen that way. What you are describing could happen, and that would be awesome. I do not believe that is what is happening or what will happen.
Why not? I mean, why wouldn't it happen?
Because that's not how art has worked so far.
I mean,
because when you make a high-end, super expensive art, then it becomes a status thing, it becomes a society thing, and it becomes a very narrow thing. And those few people make a lot of money. The other, it's the same reason the average published art author today makes approximately $15,000 a year. There's a ton of authors out there, and some of them will probably get NFT versions of their books, or some of them have first editions that are big deal, and they make millions and millions of dollars. The average author makes $15,000 a year.
Okay, but at the same time, the odds that a self-published author will be able to make a living being an author is higher than it was.
Yes.
It's not very high, but it's higher than it was. That, so that's,
I think this hits to it. This NFT phenomenon, I do not believe is going to make poor artists richer. I believe it is going to make rich artists richer.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't.
I would love to be proven wrong. But so far, the stories you hear about are not unnamed artists suddenly getting a bunch of money for their stuff.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of confidence in the stories one hears about these days, especially, but I don't know what's going to happen. I just, it seems like when I think of these, one thing
I freely admit, I have no evidence either.
When I think of this phenomena, I think of another thing I think of besides thinking of you and what you're doing is I think of myself and some of the aspirations I have. And one thing I want to do as an artist is I don't want to lock down my content. I don't want people to not be able to, you know, if by some miracle my work got popular enough that people were writing, say, fan fiction or something, the last thing I would want to do is go shut that down. Or if people were making their own t-shirts or hats based on my properties, you know, I wouldn't want to be sending cease and desist stuff after those people. I just would not want to do that. I wouldn't even see how that would help me. On the other hand, of course, I want to make money on my own stuff. And one way to do that is for people to want, like, well, I like all the stuff these people are making, but I like to get things directly from William, because first of all, I want to support him. But second of all, maybe I get a little extra boost myself as a consumer from knowing this is coming from the original creator, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how do you do that? Well, it's like you can have officially licensed stuff, and everyone else's stuff isn't officially licensed. And so there's a little status added to anything that's officially licensed. But as soon as you do actually do that officially licensing thing, it imposes legal crap that I don't want.
Yeah.
So what if this thing is a way for me to say, look, all my stuff has this unique thing on it, and if you care about that, then this is how much it's, you know, and I wouldn't go out and raise the premium on it or have people bid. I would only charge as much as anyone else charges. So the person's not going to pay more, at least I wouldn't charge them more. It's just a thing that would attract customers to my stuff so that I can still make a living while I allow legally everybody else to also make a living potentially off of my stuff if people like it.
Yeah. I mean, two things there. One, and the easy one, is you don't have to, like, you just say, if you want it, this is my website. You know you're buying it from me.
Sure.
If you buy it from my website.
Right. That's what you
can
do.
And there
now
doesn't have to be any special version.
Nope.
It can just be like, here's where I sell it, buy it from me.
Right, right.
The other thing, though, in this model that you're describing, it sounds very cool. And I suspect one of two things happens. Either it doesn't economically make much impact on you at all. You make about the same you would have anyway, because you have a small diehard fan base and they're willing to do it, but they're not willing to particularly, like, they don't, it doesn't pass around with it, or you become very, very famous and suddenly those versions are worth ridiculous amounts of money. And I don't know how I feel about that. The idea, and again, all of this is great. And, you know, you are one of the great ones who sees how things could be and asks why not. I'm the one who says that's awesome, but it's also not. I don't know why not, but it's not. And that's what I'm saying.
It's not just about, but the thing I was talking about, another thing it does is it protects, for lack of a better term, it protects the people who are buying my stuff. In other words, if a person decides, you know what, I want stuff that's based on the universes or the world building that William does. I like what this person in DeviantArt is doing. I like what this person's doing. And I'm glad William is opening it up so people can do those things. But I want stuff that comes from William, and I want to know it comes from William. You know, because anyone could say that it's licensed. Anyone could say that it comes from William. And the thing is, because William doesn't want to be a jerk about controlling this stuff, he might not catch it when someone lies and says, oh, I'm this William, you know, this is official William stuff. So I want my dollars to go to William. I know that's where they're going because William uses this special thing that can't be replicated and it only belongs to him.
Wow. I thought you just convinced me of a point that I agreed with you. And then I realized you were saying something completely different that I still disagree with. And apparently my own brain came up with the point that is causing me to agree with you. Because again, in your circumstance, I'm like, that's if it's really important to them that it comes from you, they'll find where you are and get it from there.
Well, but it's not that easy to do that though. Yes, my site, I've got a site and so on and so forth. But I mean,
Twitter has verified checks now and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'm not saying it's not easy to do knockoffs. I'm saying knockoffs usually only fool people who don't really give a shit.
Maybe that's true.
You did make me realize, essentially, this is the equivalent of signed memorabilia. This is the electronic version of signed memorabilia, and people buy that because they like that person and they think it's cool to have a little part of them. And I suppose this is a digital version, so I suppose it could turn into that, and I could be cool with that. I could like that.
Why is that? Why are you in favor of that?
Because again, it doesn't feel like it. To me, there's a distinction in my head. There's a distinction between I like having a part of this person. It does get tricky because actually with collectibles, this is the thing too. It's one to be like, this is something that matters to me and I like having what feels like an authentic part of it versus I have a bunch of these so other people can't have a bunch of these.
Well, but that those two things are sides of the same coin. I mean, that's.
Yeah. And you can't ever verify which one they are, and you can't make any sort of legal distinction or anything. So there is the potential downfall there too. I'm just really anti-capitalism these days. And this feels super capitalist to me. Recently, I'm just really pissed off at how our economy works. So. This has been getting to me too, but no, I think you make a good point here. I think, or I made a good point in the back of my brain while you were talking. Still not sure which it was, but,
well, I am not personally, I'm anti people abusing other people. I'm anti that.
Uncle people abusing other people.
I don't think free trade does that by definition.
You paused too long on that. That was worth too short on that. That was worth more. That was a great joke.
And there are aspects of small scale capitalism that I don't think are a bad thing. I think most of the time I have a problem with capitalism. It's where it's a large scale thing that starts to where there start to be a lot of incentives for people to exploit other people, but also usually by that time government is intervening. And so sometimes, you know, when people tell me they have a problem with capitalism and I ask them why, and they tell me why, and I go, oh yeah, I kind of agree with that. And then and the next thing they say is government should do X, Y, and Z. And I think, wait a minute, you want to exchange a capitalist monopoly for a government monopoly, and you think somehow that's going to be better? Well, that's not better. It's the same problem. All the same problems there. So, I mean, I don't the first thing I think of when I heard about this, I mean, I think you're right. I think I don't want to say it's a capitalist thing, but I guess it is. There's going to be ways for it to be exploited, and there's going to be things that are going to feel gross about it. The other side of the coin is it's going to empower a lot of people like me. I mean, I'm immediately thinking of all the benefits like to you or to me or to anybody else, which do I know those benefits are going to come to fruition?
Let's say it could empower a bunch of people. Let's not say it's gonna.
Right. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about all that. And most good things in the world are things that bad people can exploit, but that doesn't make the whole thing bad. That just makes those people bad. So, you know, so then I think of all the good things that a thing can be used for, and I'm sad that some bad people are going to use it for bad things, but I can't write a thing off just because a few bad people abuse it. A lot of decent people or neutral people can make something good out of it.
I agree with what you're saying, and let's end the point there because you're getting dangerously close to patronizing. So
I am?
Yes, at the point where you have to say a lot of good things out there, bad people exploit. I'm like, yeah, I'm not five. I understand.
No, I know you know that. I'm just making a point. I'm not.
I know. And what I'm saying is you're now bringing it, I'm sure in the purpose of concluding it, into broad enough terms that I feel like you're talking to me like I'm not very bright. And I know that is not your intention. And that's why I'm saying this is a good place to stop.
I'm just expressing my opinion. That's all. It's not a...
in some really, really basic terms that, again, feels very condescending to me. You've been expressing your opinion in ways that made a lot of sense. And this still does. At a certain point, it becomes big picture enough that it feels a little patronizing.
Right. But I'm not expressing it this way because I'm thinking that I'm talking to you personally. So I have to use small syllables or something like that. I'm just expressing my opinion in a very general way.
And again, I am in no way questioning your intent. I am saying, based on the way you did it through a sheer accident, because you're you and because of who I am, it is triggering feelings in me that there's no reason for us to keep going because you've made your point and I agree. And I'm starting to feel a little weird. That's all I am saying. Well, I am not accusing you of doing anything.
Nevertheless, I apologize for bringing on
any. Which is fine. I understand it was not intentional. This is very similar to the time when you would talk about how Game of Thrones seemed really obvious to you. And we knew what you meant, but we had to talk about the way you frame it. People can take it. And this is one of those things. In no way do I think you were intending to say that. For those of you joining us the first time, you're definitely not getting an explanation of how the show works. It is far too late in the episode. But hopefully you got an interesting explanation on how non-fungible tokens work. So how is your week?
We watched a lot of documentaries, and that was pretty fun. So Abby and I are interested in genealogy, and she found out that she has a ancestor who, after living in somewhere in New England, I can't remember off the top of my head where that was, and after having some kids, and some of these kids are Abby's ancestors, she left her husband, ran off with a guy who might have been a pirate. And they went to Port Royal.
Well, there you go.
And she had one other kid, I think. But she was living in Port Royal in 1692 when the earthquake and tsunami and everything happened, and she unfortunately perished there. This great, 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 great grandmother of hers, again, the child she had that Abby descends from was from the previous husband and lived in New England and whatever. Okay. The child she had with this other guy in Port Royal also perished, sadly.
So Abby technically does not come from pirate stock. She comes from stock that would marry pirates.
Which is maybe the same thing. I mean, why? No reason to.
It's but a anyway, potential pirate stock. Yeah.
The thing is, this thing that happened to Port Royal it was a huge tragedy. The city was one of the largest in the world, if not the largest in the world at the time. That's not saying a lot because there weren't very many large cities in the late 1600s. But it's still, it was fairly large. It was very wealthy. I mean, it was arguably the wealthiest city because of all of the wealth flowing through it. And of course, when it was destroyed, people, you know, the rhetoric around it was, well, this was such a terrible sin-filled city, you know, that's, it was judged by God or whatever, because there were so many brothels there, and there were so many pirates and thieves there and whatever. But because of all that, you can find a lot of documentaries about Port Royal in general, the specifically about the destruction of Port Royal, specifically about people doing archaeological investigations of the submerged city just off the coast of modern day Port Royal. So there's a lot of information out there, and we've been watching all kinds of documentaries, but we've been watching several of these in particular, and they're really interesting. And it's also, it's kind of been surprising, I don't know if surprising, but it's been interesting to, when you think you know about the life of a person who was actually there and lost, because in the process of learning about this person, she's also learned a lot about this person, right? I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of details about her life.
Yeah.
And now you're watching these documentaries, and it feels different than when you're just watching a documentary about some tragedy that happened in the past. And even when it's mentioned that, you know, that, well, we know a few things about the people in Port Royal because, you know, the bones that we've discovered, we've tested, and they're like, whoa, they found bones? I mean, like, could they have found the bones of your ancestor there? Are they talking about your ancestor when they talk about these bones? I mean, I often think about that when they talk about bones they've found in, you know, in a Anglo-Saxon site in England. I think, gosh, you know, someone's descended from that person. Or of course, when I think of indigenous skeletons that are found by Europeans and they just dig them up and test them without any regard to the people who are descendants of those people. But this is a situation where I know fairly certainly that my wife is descended from one of these people. And so it, you know, it's not an abstract sense of sympathy or empathy or whatever. It's like very personal and direct. And you're like, wow, this yeah. feels weird knowing, I don't know, it does make a difference. It does make a difference when you wouldn't think it would, or that it should, but it does.
Our ancestry ties into our personal sense of identity very often. Yeah. Now, counter to most of the documentary stuff you talk about, I'm also find this very interesting and know very little about it. However, I'm me. So I'm going to watch maximum one documentary on this subject. Given that, tell me which one to watch.
Oh, shoot.
I mean, this isn't even hypothetical. This is legit. There's no way I'm watching two documentaries on Port Royal, at least not anytime soon. But I might watch one. So which one? I'm doing this for all of you out there as well, so you're welcome.
I don't remember names very well. I think the one that I'm thinking of, there was a series that National Geographic made, and you know, we're watching a lot of National Geographic is really what this comes down to, which I love.
You said that would happen.
Yeah, National Geographic had a series of things called around the theme of draining, like draining the ocean, draining the Great Lakes, draining the, and they're really good because it's about underwater archaeology in general, and then taking scans that people have made during underwater archaeological exhibitions, and putting those scans together to show if we did drain a large body of water or a particular part, like just the Bermuda Triangle, for example, what would mm-hmm. be down there? What would the lost patrol look like if we could find it on the bottom? You know, stuff like that.
Okay.
And they did one on Port Royal. And my recollection is of once, because they're kind of blurred together because we watched lots of them. But my recollection is that was a pretty good one. That one does a good job also of showing you what Port Royal probably used to look like, which is interesting.
Yeah.
It gets into a little bit of what life was like. So I guess without me being able to distinguish some of the ones we saw, my recollection is that's probably the best one. It's probably one of the more recent ones also.
And it's presumably on Disney Plus.
Disney Plus.
Exactly. Yes, yes, yes. And it's probably called Draining the Ocean and then Port Royal or something like that.
And like draining. Yeah, I forget.
Draining something, Port Royal.
Yeah, it's a whole, they had several seasons of this thing where they did this. And actually, yeah. Some of the other ones are pretty interesting too, if you want to watch them. But the one about Port Royal is, I think, pretty interesting.
And, but it is specifically about Port Royal. It's not like the Central Caribbean or anything. Like it says Port Royal in the title.
I'm pretty sure.
All right. Yeah. Then I might watch it. You'll never know. Could happen.
I think it would interest you because Port Royal was a very interesting place.
I've been getting very into this British panel show called Hypothetical that I love because it's just like, if there was a hell for you, it would be this show.
What do you mean?
All it is hypothetical decisions, and you have to make them quickly because it's a fucking TV show. And they're all insane.
It sounds terrible.
I know. Every time I watch it, and it's what cracks me up because it's the contestants are wholly TV personalities and comedians. And ultimately, the point of the show is to be amusing. But sometimes you get two issues. Sometimes a contestant slash comedian gets too competitive about it, which is a problem because the judgment on things is incredibly arbitrary. So that's ridiculous to begin with. But also some of them get way too caught up in trying to find the right answer and forgetting that really the funny answer is the one you want, but like they'll follow them through. There's ones where like they come up with a situation and both teams have to come up with an answer and they like act it out to see what will happen. There's things where it's how much would you have to be paid in order to do X or in order to have this happen to you? Like how much would you be paid in order to have to wear a puppet of yourself on your hand for a year? And you can't explain it to anyone. And so they all bid, and whoever bids lowest, they have to like go through it. And then they get a thing where they've asked other celebrities hypothetical questions and you have to guess what they would have answered in relation to them. Like everything about it would just make your skin crawl.
Honestly, if I was wearing a puppet of myself on my hand for a year, I don't think that would surprise anybody.
No, it was pretty cool.
I didn't even ask. Oh, William's got a puppet on his hand.
Yeah,
okay.
It's fine.
Whatever, William.
They did have a scenario. It was funny because you were talking about the taking people's bones and stuff like that. And it reminded me because one of the hosts is James Acaster, and he always has like what the right answer was after they're all done. And it's usually something silly. And they had one recently where they were like, you've been on this huge bender and you wake up with a terrible hangover and the legit statue of David in bed with you. And you have 24 hours to get it back to Florence and into the museum without anyone finding out or getting in trouble. What do you do? And after they all did their thing, the answer at the end, the real answer is that you just keep it like we've always done in the UK, put it in one of our museums and claim it was ours all along.
Oh my God. That's like, hilarious. Yep. That tracks. That tracks.
That's fair.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah. That's really sad. I'm just one of those people that a lot of times when I'm watching a documentary and they're talking about some subject and they say, and we went to the British Museum to look at this, that, or the other thing. It makes me sad. It's like, I think to myself, why is this at the British Museum? There's no reason for this to be there. This does not express the cultural history.
Imperialism and colonialism is not dead.
It's not. It isn't.
Its after effects are felt throughout the world for centuries, even once it dies, and it's really still not dead. For some reason, I'm doing this kind of like a David O'Doherty song. I don't know why.
But then it happens that some country, and this country has its own museum. It has room for this thing that the British Museum has. And they say, hey, we'd like this thing back. Yeah. And that's controversial somehow. It's like,
it's not, it's only controversial with the British government. Everybody else is like, fuck yeah. Well, okay. There's probably some people on that. It becomes a left-right thing, I suppose. But most of the people I care to deal with are like, of course they should have it back. What the fuck?
Well, American museums also have things that we
absolutely, and of course we should give them back. What the fuck?
It seems like a no-brainer to me. I just don't even understand.
But we're also living in a country where reparations are finally being seriously considered, and a whole bunch of people think those are ridiculous. So finders keepers still applies, apparently.
But I mean, we live in a global digital society. You barely, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, let me put it in these terms. There have been times where in my family, a relative has passed and there's stuff, right? And some of this stuff are things that have sentimental value to us as a family. So we don't want to see it sold. We don't want to see it thrown away. And so there's a discussion about who's going to take it and have it in their house. And in our family, those conversations are not particularly difficult, because if maybe I want the thing and someone else wants the thing, but if they take the thing, I could still go see it. I mean, it's not going anywhere. It's not going to vanish. It's not going to disappear.
It doesn't really matter if I have it. This is a gross oversimplification, William. In the scenario, the only way this scenario makes sense is if, while your family's sitting around figuring this out, one of your heirlooms is some shit you stole from a neighbor 5 years ago.
Okay, but I'm just saying.
Are any of your family heirlooms shit where you went over there and broke into their house and took their crap and ran off with it? And now you're like,
the point I'm making is that the stuff that goes from, say, the British Museum to a museum somewhere in Iraq or Saudi Arabia, it's not vanishing from the world. Everyone's still going to have the benefit of it existing. There's just no reason for it to be in this museum versus this museum, except this museum reflects the actual cultural heritage of the place.
Yes. And I'm just saying that you are incredibly correct. But also, even if it was like it, they still should fucking give it back, because it's not theirs.
I know.
Even if it guaranteed no one could ever see it again in Britain, they should still fucking give it back.
No, that's true. You're right about that.
But you are right that they can still see it. And also, the internet exists now.
Yeah, so you can see it there. That's my point.
Get a non-fungible token of it.
That actually sounds like a good idea, but whatever. I'm just saying. I mean, that's a thing. It's a thing of serious concern. As a person that watches a lot of documentaries, particularly a lot of documentaries about archaeology, I'm constantly up against this when I see some great exhibit somewhere in a museum that I would probably love to see, but the museum is located in a place where I'm like, what? Why is it? Now, if it was on loan from that other country, that would be one thing, but it's not. This was taken and it's still there. I just don't.
Yep. It
does not sit right with me. It never has.
Nor should it.
Sorry, what about your week? We haven't talked about your week.
I don't know that we got time for that, but I do need to jump around. Speaking of James A. Taster and incredibly fungible tokens, it finally happened. You will recall a while back, I saw a new special of James A. Caster's called Cold Lasagna, Hate Myself, 1999, and said it was incredible and possibly one of the greatest stand-up routines I'd ever seen. It is now available for purchase. If you go to jamesacaster.com, you can buy it on Vimeo, and then you can watch it. And Vimeo can be on your smart TV, or you can cast it to your smart TV. So for anybody who's like, that sounds like it could have been cool, or for some of you out there, and I know there are some listeners who like James A. Caster, and if you didn't see it, check it out. It is awesome. Do that. The cabbage guy, you know, him. You know, the cabbage guy. William, don't pretend you don't know about the cabbage. We've had to talk about the cabbage guy, whose arch nemesis was the little boy. Because he cabbaged him. He mailed a cabbage to his house. And then he got his grandfather to... You know this. We've talked about this. We've sent you... Jazz and I have both sent you this video. It was an episode of Would I Lie to You? And he said he knew this kid because he was his arch nemesis for 6 months.
rings a bell. I'm sorry, I don't.
I'm gonna send you that video again, then I'll have to find it again. You're history's greatest monster.
I know that. You tell me that all the time.
I know. I'm really getting this thing now where my beard is going gray except right here. And I'm getting this sort of Ming the Merciless thing going. I kind of like it. Now I'm going to push the hot hail button. Do you remember that from Flash Gordon?
No.
He's making, at the beginning, Ming is pushing buttons and making all these natural disasters happen on Earth because that's how he destroys and conquers a planet. And one of the buttons says hot hail. And it is. You can see it when they're running away from it. It's these giant balls of hail and they hit, they're like steaming and stuff.
Hot.
But I'm like, hail. Why is that a thing? Yeah, hot hail. Earthquake, tsunami, hot hail. Okay. Yeah.
It's mostly just a weird thing to call it. Like you could call it balls of fire or.
Nope, hot hail.
Hot hail.
It's probably a branding thing. Balls of Fire is probably a name brand, and they didn't have that one.
Right.
So it's just, yeah, he's the spokesperson for it. Do you have a city you'd like to destroy? Use our great balls of fire. In that killer Jerry Lee Lewis impression.
Yeah.
So was Jerry Lewis named after Jerry Lee Lewis or the other way around?
I don't think there's any connection.
That's weird. I guess those are two common names, so I guess it's not. All right, my week, as fast as I can manage, because it's really my 2 weeks, I've seen a lot of movies. I've been watching a ton of movies. So, in horror movies, you know how nowadays we have to have a reason why the cell phones don't work?
Yeah.
Because now we have cell phones. We've talked about this before.
Right, yep.
Most common is it's so far out in the middle of nowhere
that
they just don't have signal.
Yep.
Sometimes you get weird ones. Oh, this building was built strange and you can't get any signal in here. And then the easy one, the cheap one, is the ghosts can make it not happen.
That's which right.
I'm like, that's fair. They're ghosts.
Totally.
Sometimes I like that better than when you try and give me like a scientist. No, the ghost did it. Well, yep, there's a new one I've discovered because I'm watching so many of those shitty found footage ghost hunter shows. The movies that we know I'm obsessed with. And I've discovered there's another trope in there. Why they can't leave the fucking building. Because they're hunting for ghosts and a ghost shows up and like eats their friend. It's like, then you should leave.
Right.
And why would you not do that? And the most common version, bizarrely, is... No, to make it real cool and authentic as ghost hunters, we're going to have them literally lock us in and we cannot leave until morning.
Really? So they don't,
yes.
The most popular one isn't a supernatural force
that's
keeping
you in. The most popular one is, as part of the shtick for our ghost hunting, we are going to have them chain the doors closed and leave, and they will come back at dawn.
Violating all fire codes and...
And everything. I have seen, I've seen a couple of variants that are more viable. There are some places where, for reasons, the building is like the building is such that it has a lockdown situation, or like they're doing it illegally and security locks the building at a certain point and won't unlock it till later. Occasionally, for security reasons, it's a stipulation of them being allowed in the building because they're worried about vagrants or whatever, which pushes it. One time they tried to leave and it was locked and they didn't know it was locked. And that was because the guy who had hired them to do it was secretly evil and wanted to make sure they stayed in there. That way.
That's but okay.
A lot of times the ghost did it. The door won't open.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly fine. But no,
right.
Far more common. On these ones is they're like, oh, this is real. And you can tell it's real because we've had them padlock us in all night.
It's got to be the ghost. The ghost has to do it.
It's just easier.
And not just that, but it's scarier. It's like,
yeah.
You know, it's like,
or
you're trapped by the ghost.
There was one that was really cool. It might've been Grave Encounters, which is a decent found footage movie where when they broke through the door and it was just another hallway, and it turned out basically the ghosts made it so it was like its own pocket dimension and you could not get out of the building.
Nice.
And it was never dawn. Because that was the thing, because somebody was going to come and get them at dawn, and they and in some of them their watches stop, and that's a great excuse. But this one, they're like, no, according to our watch, it's 10 a.m. Nice. But it's still night outside. And that one was really cool because it went for like 3 days of time trapped inside. And yeah. I liked that one a lot.
That's good. Yeah, good.
So that's a cool one to do. I have seen the goofy version of that, which is we can open the door, but we open the door and it's just black and there's like no void. And I'm like, sort of. You can be more creative, but that does work. But yeah, this is the thing. I've been watching so many of these movies, varying from kind of shitty down. And so I'm discovering the best ones are kind of shitty. And that's all I'm gonna say about those. Because there's a lot of those, but I have been seeing some other critical movies here that I have to talk about. I've been seeing some major heartbreakers. I've been seeing movies that are really neat ideas and decent movies, and I recommend them, but it is so painfully obvious like how much better they could have been in slightly different hands. And that's terrible. Going back to the old days over this, because I'm making Trish do it, we're watching the Prophecy movies.
Oh, are they any good? I mean,
That's not an easy question. Because the answer is no, but I still recommend them.
Oh, okay.
For the record, there are 5 of them. Have only ever seen 3 of them. And really, there are only 3 of them because they have a story arc. And the other 2 were released in the same year, direct to video, and seem to have a wholly different plot and don't have any of the same people.
So no Christopher Walken in those.
Which is the thing. If you can't get Walken to come back, not a good sign. And here is that is the thing. The original 3 Prophecy movies only have 2 actors that are in all 3 of them. One of them is a coroner who's played by the guy who played Banya, the annoying comic on Seinfeld. He's also been a lot of other stuff, but that's how I always remember him. And Christopher Walken. And ultimately, I feel like the movie series is a story of Christopher Walken's character. He's not the main character technically in any of them, but I feel like it's a story of his character. And I love his character because it's fucking Christopher Walken. He's amazing. And it's a neat idea. The whole thing. I realized rewatching these. Oh, we've only seen 2. We haven't seen 3 again yet. And I'm excited for 3 because the way 2 ends really sets up for an awesome 3, but don't want to spoil things. This has a lot to do with my obsession with angels as a narrative device.
Okay.
This series was one of the first things that really did the whole, let's actually look at angels, not the cute angels everybody thinks of, but like biblical fucking angels. They're kind of nuts. And it's kind of weird that we aren't aware of this fact. And also, what the hell would that mean? That like God made those things and then us, and the differences in how they were handled. And, you know, and Gaiman gets into this and stuff, and there's some great things later on, but this was sort of my first introduction to like think about angels. And then you're like, oh yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. They're definitely horror movies. There is a lot of gore. People need to be prepared for that. The first one has fucking Eric Stoltz and Elias Koteas and Virginia Madsen in it, and then none of them come back. In fact, Elias Koteas' character comes back played by someone else.
Oh wow.
Not happening. So yeah, that nobody was really into. I wouldn't call them good, but I think they're worth watching. And they're all on HBO Max, so you can watch those. But again, Heartbreaker, the concept is really cool. The execution was very mid-low budget 90s action horror, which is not a great way to do this, but I've been watching other things. Two heartbreakers in particular, one of which is weird. It was made by Shudder, but it's not on Shudder, at least not right now. But you can get it on just about any place you rent movies for like $4. And we watched it just last night. And it is called Psycho Goreman.
I mean, it sounds like truth in advertising to me.
Right? No, it is brilliant. I encourage anyone, even if you don't watch the movie, go watch the trailer. It is a brilliant idea. It is the story of an ancient evil that threatened to wipe out all life in the universe until the forces of light got together and imprisoned it in a thing and buried that so it could never be unleashed. And then two kids accidentally unleash that evil. Scary, right? Except the evil was bound with this particular gem. And whoever holds the gem can control it. And they figure this out while the, I'm going to say 12-year-old, borderline sociopathic tomboy girl in this is the one who has it. So she just turns this giant, terrifying monster into her playmate and does whatever the fuck she wants. And it's a horror comedy, go figure. Sci-fi horror comedy, I guess. Heavy on the comedy. It is also very violent and gory, but it has incredible effects, like so much awesome costuming and puppetry and stuff, and it's all very cheesy effects, but they're so good, and just so fun to watch all the effects. I really wish someone else had written it. Like, the concept and the execution and the plot are great. Every criticism I ever have at this movie, I have to start with saying, I understand that this movie isn't supposed to be taken seriously.
Right.
And that doesn't reflect well on whatever I'm about to say. But it's just so blatantly amoral and wackadoo in a way that I'm just like, I don't know who to root. I don't root for anybody. And it's not one of those like nobody had sympathy. I'm like, no. At one moment I'm like, oh, that's the person I think. And I'm like, no, they suck. I want this. No, wait. To me, the characterization is too incoherent. When you're doing shit like this, you work in broad strokes, and I get that. That didn't happen in this. This is just sort of a hot mess of traits that come in and out at different moments and stuff. And it was really hard because I was like, I don't know who I'm hoping will win.
Yeah.
But that being said, it had some laugh out loud jokes and had some really good effects, and it's a brilliant idea, and it's done really well. So I encourage you to look at the trailer, and what you see in the trailer is pretty much what you get. So you check that out. The bigger heartbreaker, and the problem with this one is I highly recommend this movie. It is only on Shudder. So most of you can't see it. At least I believe it is only on Shudder. I suppose maybe it's for sale elsewhere, but movie just came out called Lucky. It is written and starring. I didn't realize she had written it until the very end. Actor named Bria Grant, who I am kind of a fan of. She hasn't had a lot of big stuff, but I was very excited to see her in this. Trish found this movie and brought it to my attention. This is not a comedy. And what this is our main character is an author, sort of a self-help author, I guess, in a way. She writes like how to get ahead in business books and stuff like this. And she and her husband are in their house, and they're in bed, and she hears a noise downstairs, and she wakes him up, and she's like, honey, I heard something. And he said, oh, it's probably just the man that comes every night and tries to kill us. And she's like, what are you talking about? He's like, come on, let's go deal with it. Let's hope he doesn't have any good weapons tonight. And like, he grabs a baseball bat and they go downstairs and deal with this. And like, I don't know what else to say beyond that. Like that's the jumping off point. And it continues from there. And it's, I guess the same sort of thing. It is such a cool idea and it is so worth seeing. And it's a very powerful movie that's really fascinating. It is a bit maybe heavy-handed in like when you figure out what's going on, and you're like, okay, we get it now. But it's really interesting and cool. And I hated every bit of dialogue. Like it, so much of it didn't work. So much of it did tell, not show. The characterizations are awful. I mean, that's the thing is, again, we have this problem where people had conversations and I'm like, that's not a conversation that would happen. You're like right. when this person said this line, this person would not say this line. And some of it was leveraged to make things work and other times. And it just, I mean, I don't have experience with Brie Grant's writing. She might not be very polished at this point. I recommend it, but I was keenly aware I wanted it to be better. And in fact, literally the credits ran and I just turned to Trish and said, honey, how am I supposed to feel about this movie? Because I didn't know. But the acting's impeccable. It has Larry Cedar in it, and I love seeing Larry Cedar in anything, especially if it's not a commercial. The acting's really great. So I recommend it. And it's a movie. There's not a movie out there like this. So that's saying something. I just feel like it could have been better. Okay, then real quick, got to throw this out there. The Trial of the Chicago 7. Watch that.
Yeah.
On Netflix. Have you watched that?
No, I haven't yet.
So you haven't watched that?
Not yet.
Tell me what you know about the Chicago 7.
One of the reasons I want to watch it is because not as much as I'd like. I mean, I know Abbie Hoffman is involved in the trial. Isn't that right?
Abbie Hoffman is one of them. Yep.
Very little. It's kind of like Judas and the Black Messiah or whatever, which we did see. Fantastic.
Oh my God. We should have spent this whole episode talking about that.
Everybody should watch that. It's very good.
And this movie happens at the same time and some of the same characters appear, obviously played by different
people. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So yeah, it's definitely on our list, but
I'm really impressed that you knew as little as I did. Yeah, knew it was, you know, it was seven people, and although that's technically not accurate either, but you'll see. And it was a court case and it was a very big deal. If you had pushed me for details, I think I would have blurred it with the weatherman and been like, I think it was like a terrorist thing and there was like bombing and shit potentially, or like threatened bombing. Not at all. Here's some basics, and these are not spoilers. This is just history.
Right.
So, 1968 Democratic Convention.
Right. Yep.
In Chicago, there were huge protests.
Right.
And there was a huge police and National Guard presence, and it resulted in riots, and lots of people got hurt, and lots of people died. And then later, they tried these eight people for basically conspiracy to, like, the shit they should be trying the people who stormed the Capitol with. And this movie deals with that trial. And I mean that in a very little literal sense. You start by seeing everybody where they are, like before the convention's going to happen and they're planning to go and all that, and then jump cut and it's like 5 months after the convention. So like, you are not at the convention at all.
Yeah.
It's Aaron Sorkin, and it's very Aaron Sorkin. People have strong feelings about him, Me too, sometimes. If you like him, you'll like it. If you don't like him, you won't like it. It's very Aaron Sorkin. The movie and a shit ton of caffeine I didn't know I had had. Oh my God, so much of this makes more sense now. Made me very uncomfortable. I had a stomach ache through the whole thing. That's almost certainly the caffeine now, I realize. I was angry at this movie. I was pissed off when I found out it was only half over. It is an incredible movie, but here's what happens. And I haven't gotten the details enough yet, but one of two things happens in this movie. Either, and why I hate most based on a true story films, somebody took a ton of license and painted this situation that happened in 1969, I believe, and just drew these ridiculously obvious parallels to issues that we are having right now, and basically took some history and tried to convince you it was real while just giving whatever message they wanted. And I find that personally disgusting, and it pisses me off because it makes people believe this is the truth and it's not. Or this movie is a relatively accurate representation of the trial of the Chicago Seven, in which case some absolutely egregious shit happened, and it's painfully obvious that that same egregious shit is happening now and continues to happen to this day. And it bothered me for a little while afterwards because this movie made me angry in a way that Judas and the Black Messiah didn't. And it's far less violent than that film. And I'm like, I don't understand. Is this just because I'm like used to this? Like, am I okay because it's black people? Like, what's happening? Like, I was outraged, but I was so much more outraged by this. And I realized that movie and a lot of movies like it are about those people. Judas and the Black Messiah is about those people. And yes, there's a lot to be said about institutional racism and political power and things like that in it, but it's a story of those people. The Trial of Chicago 7 is much more about society and institutions. And the movie made me really angry at my country like I haven't been in a long time. Like, the movie made me hate the police and hate our legal system and hate our government in just a huge way. And it was an amazing movie. Everybody in it's incredible. Sacha Baron Cohen, Abby Hoffman, fucking brilliant. Thomas Hayden, a name I didn't know before this, played by Eddie Redmayne, and he nails that. And he's got the accent down. His British accent is sneaking in there. And I don't think of him in a part like this, but he did a great job. A bunch of actors I knew by face in it that I don't know by name. Some of them doing way cooler jobs than I have remembered before. It's I highly recommend it, unless you hate Aaron Sorkin, or you like, knowing now I might not have watched it, but if you're like that kind of shit, I want to avoid. But it's also a really fascinating bit of history that nobody talked about in my education. Like, I'm sure tons of people know lots about it because they were fucking alive and grown-ups when it happened. But like, the fact that you don't both comforts me and worries me, because this is the kind of shit, like, you know, and it was a huge deal. And like, you and I both should have known it. The fact that I don't is bad. The fact that you don't, I'm like, wow. So nobody in our age bracket really knows what the fuck is going on here.
Believe me, there's a lot. I mean, of course, some of the things that I don't know, I did hear about or read about once and I've forgotten.
And but I mean, like, I'm sure it was a paragraph in my social studies book. I mean, like, so was Vietnam.
But there's a lot of things about Black history that I've only recently learned.
Well,
I mean, that's a pretty common thing.
And that's got nothing to do with you. That's our era. And it has been a lot of mass media that has been bringing that shit out. And this is something of another version of that. This one, I think, may have been slightly more incidental because it was big national news at the time. And all the people that were around knew that. So, I mean, like, basically what it comes down to is they failed to educate the next generation who wasn't really present for us, which is us. So this can help do that.
Well, it's kind of
With the black stuff, they just, nobody ever talked about it and nobody ever reported on it. And
what this event is like for me is it fits in the same category as the Vietnam War, where you've heard of it. If someone mentions it, you go, yeah, I've heard of that. But when I was watching the news growing up, people talked about these things, but they didn't explain them.
Yes.
So it, like,
it was frequently the backstory for why every lead on a 1 hour CBS action show knew how to use guns well, because they had been in Nam.
And also the information you got was often very partisan. Like, it was either pro or against the thing, and you didn't know anything else about it.
And this is not coincidence, because the protests were in large part against Vietnam.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It was also tied into who was going to be the Democratic nominee, but it was mostly about trying to stop the Vietnam War. And what's also chilling is when you realize, like I said, this was the 1968 convention, which means this was the war was still a relatively new thing. Like, this would go on. I believe the war didn't officially stop until my date of birth, which is 77.
Wow, I don't remember. So that's what I mean. That's what it all falls in that category. That Vietnam slash counterculture slash all that stuff is, even for me, it's kind of like a cloud. I hear about it. I hear people talk about it, but I don't know a lot about it.
We don't talk about things in this country that we are and should be ashamed of. So we don't talk a lot about slavery. We don't talk a lot about Jim Crow. And we don't talk a lot about Vietnam. We talk about World War II because we were awesome. We talk about the Revolutionary War because we were awesome.
But even a lot of things that connected to it, like, you know what I mean? Like, anything kind of adjacent to it, like a lot of the counterculture stuff in the 60s and 70s, I knew a little bit about, but not that much.
Well, and a lot of it is because it was tied into that, both because of protests and because people were drawing on it. I mean, we made an entire genre of horror and action movies based on PTSD, and as near as I can tell, we discovered PTSD in Vietnam. Like, go back and look at horror and action movies in the 70s into the 80s, and they're all about freaky shit happening because of the trauma of someone who was in Vietnam. And we can't cope with it. Rambo, First Blood, was a novel about this very concept that was made into a movie about that very concept that was made into a bunch of sequels that were nothing about that.
I learned things about Watergate and I'm like, really? I thought I'd already figured out everything about Watergate. No,
I had Watergate pretty much down because I was just talking the other day to somebody about this. At a very young age, I was way too into All the President's Men.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why, but like, way too young to give a shit about that. I found that movie fascinating.
Yeah, that is a pretty good movie, though.
And it still freaks me out now that we know who Deep Throat is. Mm. I am old enough that was never going to happen. And what's funny is it happened and I didn't know about it. Years later, something came up and they're like, Mark Felt, who turned out was Deep Throat. I was like, wait, what? And I had to look it up and I'm like, shit. He told everybody this like 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And Woodward and Bernstein corroborated. I was like, how am I just now learning who Deep Throat is?
Yep. That's right. It's kind of, now that you mention it, it is kind of weird how there are certain things that you really do have to dig to find out. And if you don't, you probably won't know anything about it, at least when you're our age.
But yeah, In general, I highly recommend this movie unless you don't like Aaron Sorkin, and buckle the fuck up. Maybe not as much as Judas and the Black Messiah. That movie was rough. It was also amazing. Like, that movie, like, just on its cinematic credits is fascinating.
Yeah, my gosh. The writing, the acting, the filming.
Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya are just some of the most amazing actors out there today.
Yeah.
Lakeith Stanfield has been in a couple of movies that I have zero interest in, except Lakeith Stanfield was in them, and I'm like, maybe I should watch those. and not to discredit the female lead in it, who was amazing. I don't know her name and can't remember it, and I'm not familiar with her, and I feel bad about that. But she's also incredible in it. It's powerful shit.
It's good filmmaking.
Now watch One Night in Atlanta, or One Night in Miami.
Oh yeah, that's on my list too.
It's also like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And also has some powerhouse performances.
Right.
All right, we are like at an hour and a half, so, but there was no way I was going to remember all those movies for next week. So, lucky if you can get it. Psycho Gorman, everybody watches the trailer. Even Trish, I like tried to explain it to her. She's like, I don't think so. And then I showed her the trailer. I'm like, we want to watch that? She's like, yeah, we want to watch that. And she liked it quite a bit better than I did. So, it's horrifically violent, but it's comedically so. Like people just explode and shit. Like, it's not comic violence. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's all ridiculous violence. Yeah, Psycho Gorman, Lucky. And yeah, watch the Prophecy movies. I still think it's a neat idea. They're not great movies. They are really not. But it's a cool concept that I think is worth watching. And so we're doing this early. So I said we're an hour and a half. It's only 4 o'clock for us. This might be a thing. So you might be starting to get early afternoon William and Tony rather than late afternoon William and Tony, which should have no impact on you except the podcast might be up earlier. Regardless, keep listening or watching or both, because if you stop, we cease to exist.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.